Easter is coming, and that's the beginning of homemade chocolate season. From truffles to Maillardise and filled bonbons or meltaways, there is a lot to know and understand about making chocolate confections. My guest today is a chocolate and pastry expert and is going to give us some tips and ideas about what is possible with chocolate. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 186.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here.
Braden Cadinelli is my guest today. Braden is a pastry chef and chocolatier with over 20 years of experience in the industry. He currently oversees innovation and implementation of new products in various facilities. I find that very exciting.
Good morning, Braden. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too, because we're talking chocolate and, you know, it's hard not to think of the real Willy Wonka. And, of course, for anybody of particular age, that means only Gene Wilder, not that other guy. He's good in other things, but not that other movie. So Before we get rolling here, and by the way, that's a fondant joke, can you give us a little bit of a background into you and how that's relevant to today?
Of course, yes. Thank you so much. I originally thought, oddly enough, that I was going to be a music educator. It's what I applied to school for. I quickly learned, outside of the percussion family, I can't play any other instruments. And if you want to get into music education, yeah, they like if you can play a few different instruments. I then thought, well, you know what? I'm quite good at operations management. I'm going to get into the world of finance and operations management. And so I changed my major, and that's what I went to school for. I then decided, sitting behind this desk is quite boring. I like that Willy Wonka fellow. Only Gene Wilder, of course.
Of course.
And I said, I think I'm going to try culinary school. So I went to culinary school. And after culinary school, I decided to go back again. And I actually, just from culinary school, I have a few degrees. So I actually majored in the baking and pastry arts as well as culinary, you know, just straight up cooking. After that, though, I knew I wanted to be more in the realm of baking and pastry. And I worked in a wide variety of different establishments. So I've worked in small retail shops, both for bakery and pastry. I've worked in semi-industrial shops where you're doing almost all the work by hand. You might have a few machines to assist with some of the more kind of difficult, time-consuming tasks, right? The monotonous tasks that you really want to get away from if you need to be highly productive. And now I actually work for an ingredient manufacturer, and I've been here for 12 years. It's the Parados Corporation. And I lead all of our innovation centers. So those are our test kitchens. I oversee 6 test kitchens throughout the country. And we have roughly 20 R&D chefs who work under me in those test kitchens, testing out new products and new recipes for all of our customers. So at this point in my career, I've really gotten away from the day-to-day grind of being in the kitchen. And I'm really leading and inspiring our teams and our customers in how to bring new products to market and, you know, the commercialization process of products within the food industry.
So you really are Willy Wonka.
In a way, you could say we are. We have a chocolate factory here in the U.S. Up in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We actually have what is now the world's only carbon neutral chocolate factory over in Belgium, where we make our real Belgium chocolate under our Belkalod brand. And we have a few other chocolate factories actually spread out throughout the world, all as part of the company I work for now. So we have a few Willy Wonkas who work for us, not me specifically. We do have a few, though. Really, it is fascinating. If you've never been in a chocolate factory, it's fascinating what goes on in there.
I have not. And that's, we moved from Jersey to Oregon and we were in a time crunch. So we didn't have a chance to stop at Hershey's. Now, I'm sure that even myself included, there is a bit of a snobbery when it comes to anything chocolate and then there's Hershey's. But there's a lot to be said for the guy who has done what he's done. And I'm sure the process is mostly the same. There are refinements that can be had, but fundamentally you have to have this bean. So I realized that this could be an entire career and this is an unfair question to ask, but since we're talking about chocolate, what is chocolate?
Ah, well, for that, I would say the best answer is it's a product you get from processing the cacao bean. Right? As you said, if we're talking about real chocolate, it has to come from the cacao bean. Now, most people will jump in at this point and say, "Oh, whoa, 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 whoa! Humph, humph, humph. What about white chocolate? It's white. There's no color in there. Cacao beans are brown. It still has part of it. White chocolate has cocoa butter in it. So it's a whole process from actually getting the pods and getting out the beans and getting them to a point where you can create a food that we can process into what we think of as, let's say, a chocolate bar, Hershey's or not. What's important at the end of the day is from that bean, you're going to get chocolate liquor. And that's really where the chocolate starts. And then...
Let me cut you off now, because we're going to get a little bit into terms. And so that's a term that I know people who do any kind of work with chocolate, and usually they're going to be, that's not true nowadays, everybody, but what exactly does it mean, chocolate liquor? What is that?
Thank you. Good question. What that means is that's what you get when you break down that little kind of bean that's in the pod. If you've ever seen a pod that comes off of one of the cacao trees, you break it open and there's this white flesh inside. And then there's also these beans. And then through a process of fermenting those beans, drying those beans, roasting those beans, you get something that you can make chocolate liquor out of. And what that is it's a liquid substance, right? After you've basically put those beans through a lot of force, a lot of, I'd say, kind of sheer force. And then what you do is you can actually press that. So many years ago, a Dutch gentleman was able to invent a press. And when you put enough force on chocolate liquor, it breaks up into cocoa powder and cocoa butter. So everybody knows cocoa powder. You can get that at the store, generally in a Hershey's can, right? And there's a few different kinds. Everyone knows familiar that it's a, you know, dark brown powder substance. What you don't see in the store so much is the cocoa butter. That's the fat that you get out of the bean. And that is opaque. It is solid at room temperature, and you have to heat it to be able to work with it. That's why chocolate can be heated. And then when it gets back to a room temperature, it actually sets firm, hard. It's because of cocoa butter. It's actually a polymorphic fat. And stop me when we start to get too technical. What that means is it has a crystalline structure in there, and it can set in many different forms. You can almost think of each form as a shape, right? Sometimes the fat crystals might align themselves in triangle shapes or sphere shapes or square shapes. And when we're working with liquid chocolate now, which is that chocolate liquor, and we've added sugar to it, we've added maybe an emulsifier to it, although the industry is kind of getting away from emulsifiers in some ways. We've added some vanilla to it. When we're working with it, we have to work with it at certain temperatures and in certain ways to make those fat crystals want to align in a stable structure, right? We want, let's say, squares that are all going to stack up very nicely. And whenever you work with chocolate, you're always looking for really three attributes. After you've finished and the piece is set, you want it to shine, right? Good chocolate should be shiny if it's handled well. When you break it, it should snap. It should not bend. It should give you a nice clean snap. I think about when you were a kid and you open up that chocolate bar, how satisfying that is. Oh, you just want to break that piece off, maybe with your hands, maybe with your teeth, right? Depends on just how aggressive you're going to be that day with the chocolate bar. And then the third attribute, and this is more for the production of it, it should shrink. And the reason we need tempered chocolate, that's what we call it after we've properly worked with it and we've adjusted the temperatures just so. The tempered chocolate should shrink because we need to get it out of the mold. If we put it in a mold and it doesn't constrict back just a little bit, we can't get it out. Everybody nowadays, right? Most people, you're on social media. You probably see a lot of these chocolatiers. They love to make videos of them flipping their chocolates out of molds. And they get really excited when they all come out at once and it's just perfect and the mold is empty. Wouldn't do that if it didn't shrink. And of course, they want them to be shiny when they come out of the mold. And when you bite into it, it's going to give you that good snap.
Well, having made Maignardise and Friandise, I can tell you that there's a tremendous amount of satisfaction when they actually do all come out of the mold. Like, man, because it's validation. So let's back up a little bit. These little shapes, triangle, rectangle, rounds, you're talking the crystalline structure mostly at a molecular level where these different shapes of fats are in there. And so you mentioned tempering, and so
yes,
I want to get into that. So there's a couple of ways that people at home can do that. They can you can buy for some quantity of a few hundred dollars a tabletop temperer. Looks like a giant crock pot. It has a stainless steel bowl and it spins and there's an incandescent light bulb and it works pretty good. I use one of those at a club in Tallahassee. And then you can go to a chocolate shop and they have this massive contraption for several thousands of dollars. This big metal wheel that spins and just like, wow, it's mesmerizing. You can kind of just get lost in watching chocolate spin because it's really cool. And so there's a whole, it has waves and it just does things and it's really awesome. Let's get out of the chocolate shop and go back home. And at least two ways that I can think of, either you're using this tempering machine that spins and keeps the chocolate moving so that it doesn't harden, or there's the other method that has befuddled me always, which is tempering on the counter, pouring X amount of chocolate on the counter and then adding other chocolate to it. So I can't do it. That's the truth. I can't successfully do it. I probably could, but man, it just eludes me. So can you explain how to do that process and what's happening? We have this rectangle and square and round and rhombus and trapezoid. What are we trying to do? What does it mean? So we've discovered that at the end of this, we're going to have to shine, snap, which we love that part, and then shrink so that it comes out of the mold. But how is that being accomplished? What's going on either on the tabletop or on the countertop or in that bowl? What's happening?
Well, what you're doing is you're trying to create the stable form of crystal. So when you heat the chocolate, you are melting all of the crystalline structure. Think of it this way. This is one of the best ways I tell people to think about it. Think about a stick of butter. All right. What happens when you melt a stick of butter? It goes from being, you know, a solid stick of butter to a puddle. You've melted all of the fat crystals in there. It is, you have changed their structure. Now, the difference with butter and chocolate is once you've melted the butter, well, that's it. Now, when it hardens, it's going to be a different texture. You can't put it back the way it was, the way you got it from the store. You can with chocolate because of how cocoa butter works. So what you're trying to do after you've completely melted the crystalline structure of the chocolate is to put it back so that it's stable. The reason you're doing this generally is because you want to change the shape the chocolate is in, or you want to use it in an application. Maybe you want to enrobe a candy or change the shape by putting it in a mold. Let's take your example of tabletop tempering on a slate of marble. And then I'll actually tell everybody the way that I do it at home and a way that works at home fantastically. What you're doing when you're tempering the chocolate on the table is you create the stable crystal structure through manipulation, mechanical action, taking a metal spatula and working the chocolate back and forth naturally will align the crystals in a stable pattern. And it's called the beta five. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for these beta five crystals. Now, what you do is you actually take that chocolate that's on the table and through working it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Very impressive, time consuming, but impressive. You've created these stable crystals. Now, the temperature, though, that that chocolate is now, it's too cool to work with. It won't flow nicely into your mold. It won't flow over the candy that you want to cover. It's not really usable at that temperature. That's why you have the warmer chocolate still in your bowl off to the side. Because what you do is you take that chocolate off the table that's too cool. You mix it with the chocolate in the bowl that's too warm. And now you've made Goldilocks happy because everything is just right. You have the proper crystalline structure in the chocolate and you have the correct working temperature. And that will vary whether you're working with white chocolate, milk chocolate, or dark chocolate. They have different working temperatures. And actually, depending on the method of tempering, you can play with those working temperatures. So there are actually different methods of tempering that allow you to work with the chocolate at different temperatures. Now, at home, there's another method called the seeding method. This is, generally speaking, a foolproof method if you're at home. The way this works is all chocolate that you buy is already tempered. They had to temper it at the factory to deposit it into the little coins that you got it in or the little bars or whatever it is, right? Now, as long as that chocolate has not been temperature abused, it is still in temper. So what you do is you melt your amount of chocolate and then you add unmelted chocolate to it. That unmelted chocolate will seed the melted chocolate with the stable crystal structure. And what you do is you stir it. And as it's cooling, then you will align all of the crystals in the chocolate to that stable structure. And that will temper your chocolate. The only times that that method doesn't work is if the chocolate you're using to seed is not actually in temper. And you can generally tell because it will look very streaky. That's called fat bloom when it looks very streaky. When it looks white and spotty, that's sugar bloom, and that's usually more environmental or a sign of old chocolate. So if the chocolate is not tempered, the method won't work. Or if you don't let the chocolate cool down enough, the method won't work. When you're seeding, you have to let the chocolate cool down enough, which for dark chocolate is generally about 88 degrees Fahrenheit. And for white chocolate and milk chocolate, it's generally 84 to 86 degrees Fahrenheit. So you really have to make sure that you're respecting the temperatures in there.
Man, there's a lot there. When I used to, back in the kitchen, when we used to do, people love chocolate covered strawberries and look fine. And I bought a chocolate tempering thermometer, which is a very specified range, so it's easy to read. And what I would do is I think we were buying from a company. It was for restaurants, for commercial application, a company called Swiss Chalet.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, Swiss Chalet made some pretty stinking good chocolate. fun to eat, tasty. And so the recommendations were, it's been a long time, I think go up to maybe 120 and then come cool over an ice bath and then go back up. It's like, wow, this is an awful lot of work, but it's part of the process of what you're explaining is getting all of those weird shapes into, I think we're talking about some uniformity, some homogeneity of consistency so that when it's done, we have those three characteristics. We have the shine, the snap, and the shrink. And it's very satisfying when that happens. And you can, chocolate will, you won't know until it's done. Chocolate will tell the tale on you right away when it's cool. If you get fat bloom, you go, oh my goodness. So that's really frustrating. And so that's one of the things the people who are at home who are listening to say, I want to give this a shot. And you can go to your local grocery store and there are from a couple of different pretty well-known, probably worldwide brands to maybe lots of them, especially if you go to the organic section. Mm-hmm. Or there's always the choice of Hershey chocolate chips. And it seems that those chips work all the time. You can melt them. You haven't got to do anything fancy to put it in the microwave till it's melted, dip your strawberries, and everything's fine. Is there something not advertised? I'm not trying to be be sinister here or shady, but it seems like there's something else inside of the ingredients of those chocolate chips that isn't in the Lindt or I can't even think of this. There's too many to recall. Toblerone isn't the same, but what's going on in those chips that makes them not bloom?
That is another great question. And everything that I'm saying about chocolate, we're talking about what professionally is known as couverture chocolate. That means that it has a certain amount of cocoa butter, that fat in it. So what you're doing is you're taking the chocolate liquor and you're adding more fat. The couverture chocolates we work with always have more fat than you would find in an actual bean. So if you look at the percentage of fat in just a bean, the chocolates we're working with professionally will have more than that amount of fat. What you're experiencing with chocolate chips, there's a few different parts at play here. They are not going to have nearly as much fat. If you've ever melted chocolate chips down, you're going to see that they are much thicker when you've melted them than when you melt down professional chocolates.
They also tend to hold their shape.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, that's the second part. Now, chocolate chips, chocolate chunks, anything that's sold as baked stable generally has dextrose added to it. And that dextrose is what's helping them keep their shape. And that, so when you bake them, cook them, whatever you know you're doing in the oven, they're holding their shape. And that's generally why it's that dextrose. So you have a few different parts at play. You have less fat in the product, and you have this sugar added to it to help stabilize and help it keep its shape. Now, what a lot of times what's happening, if you're talking specifically about strawberries, if you're pulling the strawberries right out of the fridge, the temperature of those strawberries is actually helping to cool the chocolate fast enough. And that's another aspect that's helping to keep it from blooming. You can use untempered chocolate on frozen items. And if you have all the temperatures just right, it won't bloom. Now, it will have a little bit of a softer set to it at the end of the day once it's come back up to temperature. Generally, we do this on items where we need to get a dip on them, maybe a very thin dip. A lot of times we might dip them in untempered chocolate when frozen. And oftentimes we're actually mixing a hint of oil in as well. So there are these different tricks about playing with the temperature of what you're putting the chocolate on to get this effect and to have it not come out bloomed. So that's in your example here with the chocolate chips. In my opinion, those are the three factors that you're seeing at play. You're working with a chocolate that has a lot less fat if it's a chocolate chip. It has a stabilizing agent, dextrose, added to it. And if you're dipping something in it that's already cold, that's helping to kind of force those crystals into a line, so to speak, a lot faster.
If there's less fat in the chip, doesn't that mean by default that there's a higher cocoa mass?
Generally speaking, yes. So you're going to have more of the cocoa powder in there percentage-wise than you might if it is a professional chocolate. It all really depends. So this can get very interesting. So, you know, whenever we look at chocolates professionally or any product, really, we always ask for something called a TDS, a technical data sheet. And what we can figure out from that technical data sheet is basically how much cocoa butter is in there versus how much of the cocoa mass is in there. Because we could have two chocolates that both say they're, for example, a 65% chocolate. It's 65%, though, of anything that came from that original bean. That's all they're telling you. They're not telling you what the percentage is within that 65%. So we as professionals actually have to know how much of the different aspects of the chocolate are in there, right? How much of the mass, how much of extra cocoa butter, because that's going to affect what we can make out of it if, let's say, it's a chocolate that is 65% and it has a very high ratio of cocoa butter, they would do that if it's going to be more for coating, because the more cocoa butter you put in, the thinner the chocolate will be when it's melted. Now, let's say it's a chocolate with a high percentage of cocoa butter, probably not good for making a chocolate mousse out of. You're going to have a very firm, very stiff chocolate mousse. It won't be as soft and velvety as you want it to be. So you are hitting on some great points, because just because it says semi-sweet chocolate chip, just because it says 65% chocolate, they're not all the same, they're not all equal, and there can be a lot going on behind the scenes that will affect the final result of what you're going to get with what you're trying to make.
Huh. All right. So I know that we can go to the store and mm-hmm. even though I probably might have more practice and a little bit more exposure to these variety of chocolates than most home cooks. Mm-hmm. When I go to the store, I'm not going to buy, Barry Calibo 5 kilo slabs of chocolate. That's just not going to happen, because I'm not going to mm-hmm. go do it that fast. I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to buy something close to the size I need to use. Mm-hmm. So I can, just like everybody else is going to go make a batch of brownies or a batch of chocolate buttercream or dip strawberries or really push it and make some mignardises. I don't want to have more product lying around than I need, because chocolate doesn't get better with age. So mm-hmm. I'm going to go look at my store, and I have the big brand here and the big percentage on the front is Lindt. Mm-hmm. And I can get 50, 55, all the way up to, I know there's an 85, there might be a 90, which, whew, getting chewy mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think you just said that we can't assume just because it says 90, the sum total is 100. If it's 90% cocoa mass, I'm assuming that means it's 10% cocoa butter. Did you just say that that's not exactly what I'm going to be getting, because the TBS correct. Would be, oh, all correct. Right.
So here's what it's telling you. That 90 is telling you that 90% of everything in that bar came from the bean. It could be 85% was the mass, which is, cocoa powder and cocoa butter all mixed together, and then an extra 5% of just extra cocoa butter thrown in, right? So whatever that 90 is, if it's 90% of that bar started out in a pod on a tree. It came from the cacao. 10% is everything else, sugar, vanilla, lecithin, whatever it might be. That's what the percentage is telling you.
Be a guest on the perfect podcast, or find the perfect guest for your show. Podmatch puts hosts and guests in one place to find the perfect match. Braden and several other guests are Podmatch members. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/podmatch, to sign up today and find your perfect podcast match.
So the one thing we can be pretty sure about as a percentage goes is the higher mm-hmm. the percentage, the more bitter that bar is going to be, the more robust chocolateness we're going to get out of that. And anybody who's bitten into a 90 thinking it was, if you get, now this is where nomenclature gets really screwy, because I don't think there's codification between company A and company B calling a product milk chocolate, semi-sweet, bittersweet. I think that's, maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that's sort of selective to the company. So that really screws things up. But most people say they like bittersweet chocolate. You give them a 90, you're like, what is this? It's like, mm-hmm. it's like taking, I don't know if you've ever seen, it's painful to watch, but it's really, really funny. Somebody eating a tablespoon or a teaspoon of cocoa powder. It's like the cinnamon challenge. It's the same thing. It's just, oh my goodness, it's cruel. Don't do that to people.
Yeah, no.
Wait till April Fool's and next year. Looking pretty fast. All right, I'm going to see if we can cover back a little bit of space. For you said something to the effect of getting to the right temperature. Mm-hmm. Getting down, so white chocolate and milk chocolate, I think you said 84, and bittersweet, 88.
Yeah, roughly, yes.
How high do we have to do like I was doing, and that's get it to a higher point mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. all of those? So are we turning all those shapes fluid so that they yes. realign themselves? Okay, now, is it possible to go too high? What happens yes. instead of going to 120, we went to 145?
Mm-hmm. What are if we doing? If you go too high, you're burning it. I mean, just like anything, you're burning the chocolate. If it's white chocolate, you'll see it. It'll change color. You have to remember in white chocolate, yeah, you'll smell it exactly. You know, there's a lot of sugar in chocolate. So the main thing you'll see first off, if it's not a color change in white chocolate, is you'll see the chocolate start to thicken. That's a big one to tell you that you've heated it too much and that you've burned it, right? It'll start to thicken and you might start to see it kind of clump up, seize up in the bowl, kind of around your stirring implement. And those are a few different ways to see that you've probably burned it. Now, you've actually said something very interesting here. If I can shoot on a small tangent, you were talking about playing with the temperatures and we're talking about people at home. Anyone who's serious about probably working with chocolate at home, they may have a very interesting piece of equipment that has nothing to do with chocolate, but can help them temper chocolate. And it's based on what I said earlier, that all chocolate should come to you pre-tempered. If you have an immersion circulator, you can vacuum seal your chocolate, put it in a water bath, set the immersion circulator to the correct working temperature, and then just walk away. And you can leave it like that, set it in the morning if you want the chocolate overnight, set it at night if you want it in the morning. It's a great way, because something else you said made me think, and that's when you talked about small amounts, right? I have machines at work where I throw 30, 40, 50 pounds of chocolate in the machine to temper at a time. Nobody at home is doing that. Even trying to melt, you want to melt generally if you're trying to temper it with the seeding method or tempering it on the marble, you want to melt about a pound of chocolate at a time. That's kind of your minimum. This method, though, if you have an immersion circulator and you have the time, it can be great because you can put any amount of chocolate in that bag, vacuum seal it, put it in the water bath and melt it. And as long as it was in temper and you don't take it over the working temperature, so between 84 and 88, depending Fahrenheit, you're golden. You're good to go.
So sous vide has a whole new mm-hmm. purpose.
Yes, it does.
I have it just takes up a lot of space. I'm limited like everybody else at home. Mm-hmm. I'm limited in a counter space and I have to be very particular about what is it that's going to take up my space. And sous vide just doesn't interest me, but maybe. Interesting. So let's give a caution. I want to talk about two things and they're kind of mm-hmm. related. So putting a bar into a vacuum sealed bag, putting that bag into the water seems every single time an expression of purest optimism in the integrity of the plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And because if there's even the smallest hole, mm-hmm. we got a problem.
Yes.
So that problem is going to go back to our seized white chocolate problem.
Mm-hmm.
Dark chocolate of any particular quantity of number or sugar does not like water. But so now if you get water in, this is really your territory, but if you get water in your tempered chocolate, you're not dipping any berries. However, now we have this seized dark chocolate or this slightly burnt. Now, burnt is a weird thing to say, because technically we're talking correct, but we think burnt, we're thinking carbon in the bottom of the pan, and that mm-hmm. isn't necessarily the case with white chocolate. But, I mean, you can get there, but burnt mm-hmm. seized is another thing. So,
yes, yes.
We've got chocolate we can't use for our intended purpose, but how do we save burnt white chocolate that isn't to the taste burnt or see the dark chocolate? What do we do? Mm-hmm.
Well, burnt white chocolate, that one can be pretty tricky. Depending on how badly you've done it, you can grab a sieve and you can push it through there and you'll capture the really bad parts and you might have something come out the bottom that you can use. A lot of times, though, once you've done it, it's done. A lot of times it depends on how much you were trying to heat. The smaller the amount, the faster it's going to happen, and generally the worse it's going to be because it's going to happen so quickly. Now, with the dark chocolate, that's interesting because what's happening there is you don't see it, but there's a dry component in that melted chocolate. It's the cocoa powder. So the cocoa powder wants the water. So when the water is introduced, the cocoa powder says, oh, gimme, 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 and it grabs onto the water and it separates out, and that's what seizes it. Now, right now, plant-based, vegan, huge, huge trend. Everybody wants plant-based vegan desserts. Vegan ganaches are made oftentimes with water, sometimes with oat milk, almond milk, soy milk, but the original ones were with water.
But even those fundamentally are water.
Right. The trick here is that you're adding enough. It's just like making a regular ganache with cream. Cream is only 34, 36% fat. There's still actually a lot of water in it. It's all about the amount. So if you have introduced water to your dark chocolate, what I would say is, you know what? Add more water to make a delicious ganache. You'll have to add some fat to get the texture just right. But now you have a delicious vegan ganache. So you're very on trend. Put that up on TikTok, Instagram, whatever it is you do, right? Throw that up there. Say, look at me. I'm so cool. I made a vegan ganache. But then probably start over for dipping. Interestingly enough, though, if you're talking about, let's go back to our strawberry example, I love dipping strawberries in ganache because you get rid of the entire problem of having to temper chocolate or worry about that. Also, when you put them back in the fridge, a refrigerator over time will bloom chocolate if it's in there long enough. Ganache,
yes,
it won't.
Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy, yeah. Boy, and more than a few cooks put, oh, chef, I put the tray in the fridge. You did what? Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you make a ganache and you dip the strawberries in the ganache, it's not going to bloom when it's put back in the fridge, and it's going to look nice and shiny if you do the ganache right. And when you bite through that strawberry, there's no hard outer shell to crack and fall off. Have you ever had that happen? Oh, it's the worst. You got that strawberry, you go to, and then the chocolate, a lot of times it happens when the chocolate layer is too thick and you bite through it and it cracks and just fall out. And then you're in your nice suit or whatever, because maybe it's Valentine's Day and that's why you got these, and you go,
yeah.
Oh, now I got to go to the dry cleaner. Nah, just dip the strawberry in ganache. It's that's a brilliant solution.
That is a brilliant solution. And oddly enough, and I have no idea why, that never occurred to me. And all of the berries I dipped, it never occurred to me to do that. Although I think we did that with raspberries. It's like, look at mm-hmm. us, how smart we are. But somehow we weren't smart enough to figure out
yeah.
one works for the other. How either disappointing or I don't know. We exchanged email before we talked, and mm-hmm. I showed off my chocolate knowledge by using a big fancy word called eutectics, mm-hmm. which now I learned about that. There's in a town called Somerville, New Jersey, and I hope she's still there. There's a little off the main street, a little chocolatier called Carol. Mm-hmm. Carol's a very nice lady. She's there every day. Carol's specialty is meltaways.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Carol she had one of those big, they had two of those big plate tempering machines. She had all the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to get into truffles, but the thing about the meltaways is there's something, so there's this little simple looking square of chocolate, maybe 3/8 or 1/2 inch thick, and you put it in your mouth, and it is, you're just transported to nirvana. And there's so, because we're going to get a little bit technical here, let's talk about what's going on there for people who are at home or want a challenge. This mm-hmm. is your challenge. The gauntlet has been thrown, so to speak. We're going to take some things in fats and stuff. We're going to line them mm-hmm. up in a particular way. Tell us, what does eutectic mean? How do you get it? And then there was another word you used talking about flow.
Yeah, rheology. Yeah, the study of how something flows. Well, I'll preface this with, I am not a food scientist. My wife is, I can go grab her and get her on here. So hopefully she can't hear me to come yell at me as I might possibly get things slightly off than how she would describe them. She's also a chocolatier. That's her specialty in food science. So you might be getting me in trouble. Let's start with the first one, eutectic. So eutectic is pretty much a mixture of different items that when put together have a melting point that's lower than the separate melting points of the items that you combined. So in this instance, meltaways in confectionery world are generally made from chocolate and coconut fat. That's oftentimes what you're seeing. You can also make them with peanut butter. You could make them with hazelnut paste. There's different ways to make them. One of the classic ones, though, is coconut fat. And if you are going to do that, I always recommend people buy the deodorized coconut fat, because otherwise whatever you make is going to taste like coconut. It's just a very important fact that people sometimes forget. That, though, on its simplest terms, is a eutectic. You've taken two materials, you've combined them, and you've created a new material that has a melting point lower than the separate melting points. That's why when you put that melt away in your mouth, well, it does as advertised. The name says it all. It just melts away. It's gone thing. As if it was never there.
Sheer joy. It's just absolute pleasure.
And the key there with the meltaways is really the, again, temperatures with all things chocolate. Normally you make meltaways from tempered chocolate, and then you have your other fat, whatever it may be, that's been warmed enough to be worked into the chocolate. And it's just about mixing them together. And then there's actually generally a tabling process. And that's, again, about aligning the fat crystals. And almost anytime you table something in confectionery, it's about either, it could be about aeration, or it's about really mechanically manipulating some kind of fat structure to get it where you want it to be. And then once you have the meltaway mixture at the right temperature, right, you're going to put it in some kind of frame. You're going to let it harden, and then you can cut it. And then once it's cut, generally speaking, you always dip or enrobe it in chocolate so you can actually handle them. Otherwise, they will, when you pick them up, just melt away because your body temperature melts them.
Right.
Yeah, the second part, I just kind of jokingly got back to you, rheology. I mean, people study volcanoes and they study the rheology of lava. You know, you can study the rheology of kind of any, I'd say, liquid. It's just a matter of flow. It's just looking at how something flows. So in chocolate, it's generally tied to, oftentimes we always just talk about the viscosity, really. We simplify it. You know, it's how viscous, how much does this run? How fluid is this? And that can be important just based on your application. And if you are buying professional packaged chocolate, you know, that we buy for pastry kitchens or bakeries, they oftentimes have a system of five little dots and they look like little drips of chocolate. And generally speaking, the more of those drips that are on the package, the more fluid the chocolate is going to be when it's melted down. So the better it's going to coat something, the thinner it's going to coat. And you can actually, again, I said this earlier, if you're at home and let's say you have a slightly thicker chocolate and you need to thin it out, oftentimes you can just add a small amount of oil, right? Vegetable, soy, canola. It doesn't matter. It can be olive oil if you like the flavor in the chocolate. You just start with a little bit and you whisk it in there to the melted chocolate. And then you can use that. You just have to be careful you don't go overboard, because again, the chocolate will set too soft and then it won't be good in application.
Can you use ghee?
Yes, as long as yes. It just, again, like we were saying, it just comes down to the water. So as long as you've removed the water, which, you know, for ghee, you've pretty much, there's no water left in there, then you should be okay. I've actually never personally tried it. That's a cost concern professionally. Right. Most industrial plants don't want to commercialize something with ghee. Right. I though don't see an issue as long as you are using, again, it's just about using pure fat.
Well, I don't buy seed oils at all. Mm-hmm. That actually has been another show, but they're not worth eating. They're very, very bad. Is cocoa fat, is cocoa butter 100% fat, or is it 99.999% fat and a little teeny bit of water? I mean,
that's a great question for a food scientist. If only I actually had one handy, but she's not here at the moment.
Okay.
So, whenever.
at home, we can say that it's pure fat.
Yes. I was just going to say, in any training I've ever had, I did actually originally in college, when I went to UMass, I did take a few food science courses. We never, though, they weren't anything specific. So any training I've had has always been in culinary settings, and it's always told that it's 100% fat.
And even if it isn't, the difference is so indistinguishable exactly. that it's not going to alter what we do with that mm-hmm. product. Okay.
No, exactly.
I mentioned truffles, and there's another thing I want to get to, but can you just give a, there's two things about truffles. One, mm-hmm. and I don't know anything about your company, so I don't want to step on your toes if this does no, that, mm-hmm. but the main, the well-known big chocolatiers, you go to them in the malls.
Mm-hmm.
And they have truffles, but they're inside of a hollow casing. And mm-hmm. they ship the casings over. And I understand part of that is so that there's a consistency, mm-hmm. so that yep. there's a portion control, because portion control is cost control. It's also for ease of handling, and you can do lots of flavor combinations. I get all that part. Mm-hmm. I just hate it. I can't stand those things. It's just, it's cheating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather have the really good truffle. I want the filling part. I don't care about the outside. Mm-hmm. So what is an attribute that makes a really spectacular truffle? And then let's talk about your own favorite flavor complements and flavor contrasts with chocolate. Because to okay. me, I hate mint with lamb, can't stand it. But I love mint with chocolate. And I realize mm-hmm. that's probably maybe a hackneyed combination, but it mm-hmm. pleases me. So
yeah,
what's a great truffle? I mean, as far as ratios go, what makes a great mm-hmm. truffle? What are the attributes and then flavors?
Of course. Well, I'll jump ahead. I'll get back to it, but I'll just lead with, you know, lamb and chocolate. Should try that one.
That's I'll a good idea. I'll tell you what, you might be thinking you're cheeky. Pubacus has a
oh, yeah.
braised venison and pruned with chocolate mm-hmm. stew, which
yeah.
well, not it's absolutely superb. I'm not kidding. I made it 1 year.
Oh no, I yeah.
a whim. It's oh my god.
Yeah.
So yeah, that makes perfect sense.
No, I'm being a little silly. In all seriousness, though, I mean, I love. Everybody knows a good mole. There are though a lot of yeah. uses for chocolate oh, in savory cooking. I'll get though to a truffle. So in its simplest, a truffle is a ganache. And what is a ganache? A ganache is chocolate and it's heavy cream. That's how it was originally. Nowadays, as I said, people make them with water, oat milk, anything you can imagine. In its simplest form, though, you have your chocolate, you have your heavy cream. You don't need anything else. For texture, people will generally add, depending on kind of how much money you have to spend and what your customer is willing to pay, you're either going to use corn syrup, glucose, or tremoline. Those are kind of the three big ones that people add. Those are all types of sugar. They're syrups. And you add those really affect the texture of the truffle. What you need to do, though, is the basic structure of it is the same. For dark chocolate, it's generally two parts chocolate, one part heavy cream. For milk chocolate and white chocolate, it's generally 2.5 parts chocolate is what you're looking at, because those are already softer chocolates. So if you add more cream, you're going to get a softer result. From there, though, you can really play around, and it depends on what you want to do. So really traditionally, you would make your ganache, you would put it into a pan to solidify, and then you would scoop it out and roll those in your hand and then move on from there. So you need one type of ganache to do that. You need a little firmer ganache so you can scoop and roll. So you need a little less cream. What a lot of places do, though, is they will actually pipe their truffle. So they'll put the ganache in a piping bag once it's crystallized and they'll pipe it. And for that, you can actually use a little softer ganache, because what professionally you're generally doing is then running it through an enrobing belt. So imagine a conveyor belt that's moving its way through Willy Wonka's waterfall of chocolate. That's an enrobing belt. And that's going to enrobe those softer centers, because you're not handling them as much. So there you can kind of use a little more heavy cream. Now, I had talked about the corn syrup, the glucose, the tremoline. Those you're going to add. Again, there's a rough rule that says approximately 20% by weight of your cream can be one of these sugars. There's people I've seen who do 5, 10%. There's people who've seen who do 40, 50, 60%. All you're doing is you're really affecting the kind of elasticity of the ganache and the final texture. Generally for a truffle, it is always going to be on the lower end because you want it to be something that you can either roll or pipe, and it needs to hold its shape because it's not being piped into a mold. You haven't put chocolate into a mold and created a hollow cavity for it. The other thing that those sugars are doing is those do help with shelf life because you can increase the shelf life by adding sugar. And sugar does that in everything, cakes,
right?
You know, any kind of baked good.
For taking X quantity of ganache and adding something else to it, doesn't matter what it is, but in this case, it's going to be a syrup. It seems we're also decreasing its solidifying quality.
Yes.
So we're diluting how hard it's going to set up.
Yes.
Could you use honey? Say you wanted not just honey, who cares? But say you've got like some buckwheat honey has a very potent, I find a very desirable flavor. Something like Tupelo, which is a great honey, but its flavor is really refined. If you put it into a dark chocolate, to me, you're just wasting Tupelo honey.
Yeah.
But would honey work to do the texture enhancement, which sugar is going to do, liquid sugar is going to do? Interesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There are definitely honey ganaches. And then the only last part that I didn't mention yet is soft butter. Because again, you are, as you said, you're affecting how firm this ganache is going to set up by how much cream you add to it. There's almost always a component of butter being added to add that fat back to the ganache and to help with the texture.
Yeah, butter gives it a really nice velvet quality.
Yeah, and you're always going to use soft butter, and you're going to add it as the ganache is cooled a little bit so that you don't have the example we spoke of earlier where your butter is a pool, because you don't want to destroy the structure of the butter in this case. You don't want those fat crystals to overheat in the butter.
Butter is an emulsion that you can't refix.
Exactly.
So I think in a case like a ganache like that for a truffle, you would probably want to go with what they call the European butters, which tend toward a higher butterfat content, which means less water. If butter is only two things, if there's fat and not fat, so it's got to be liquid. That's not completely true, but that's another show.
Yeah, simple enough. Yeah.
So if you're using the store brand butter, you might be adding more water to your thing, which, because we have the cream in there and the extra fat, probably won't cause any problems, but. And it might end up being, maybe no one really can tell the difference, except your pocketbook will tell the difference, because you spend four times as much on a pound of butter that you would have otherwise. Interesting. All right.
Yeah. And for flavor combinations, I always tend to go a little kind of outside, I think, what most people enjoy. Or what I should say is that most people might actually think of off the top of their head. There is a really popular, in my opinion, one that I do love, and that is tea specifically. For me, milk chocolate, and I'll actually make a ganache that's a mixture of milk and dark chocolate. That's a good trick. If you don't want all the milkiness from a milk chocolate, mix a little dark chocolate in the ganache. I'll make that though with chai tea. I love a good chai tea. Right along those lines, I love a good five spice or seven spice or nine spice. I mean, you pick the cuisine that you like.
I can see that.
Find their spice mixture. They're almost always going to involve cinnamon. Pretty much all the ones I've seen have some level of cinnamon in them. Once you have some of those, what we consider more baking spices, right? Your cinnamon, your nutmeg, your clove, something in that family, allspice, cardamom. You can make a really, really nice ganache. using those spice mixtures that are already available. But especially Chinese five spice is great. Makes a really good ganache.
Makes perfect sense. That's a good idea.
Another one that I really like is sweet soy sauce. So what you can do when making a ganache, because you can make it with any liquid, you can take out a percentage of cream and add another liquid, alcohol, juice, fruit puree, whatever you want. The more cream you take out, the more butter you add back, because you need the fat for that mouthfeel and that texture. So something to me, sweet soy sauce can be really good. Another one, kind of along the same lines, tahini. You can replace actually all of the fat, all of the cream. So you can actually make a ganache that is made with cream, or you can make a butter ganache, which is made differently, but you can make a tahini ganache, or you can use hazelnut paste. Any of these nuts or seeds that are very high in fat, you can make a ganache out of. And especially for me, tahini is a great ganache, especially for people who can't have peanuts. You can really mimic pretty close the taste of peanuts with tahini. You can fool a lot of people by using tahini instead of peanuts.
Especially with all that other flavor going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a little trick. Yeah, it's a little trick we use for nut-free baking and pastry is substitute tahini for the peanut butter, or sesame for the peanuts.
Has anybody made tahini out of black sesame seeds?
I've never seen it commercially available. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's not my area of specialty. I've seen chocolate tahini. I have not seen it, though, out of black sesame seeds. That's a very interesting question.
Because they have a slightly more robust flavor. I mean, they're teeny, so hard to tell, but they aren't the same. Interesting. That's a very, very clever idea.
Let's take a moment out for words from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
All right, so I'm going to move into a different part of the show, which is just a kind of a short answer, but feel free to say more than two words.
Okay.
Of the five flavors, bitter, salty, sour, sweet, or umami, which one is your favorite?
Ooh, the first one that comes to mind is sour. I really enjoy something that is sour and well-balanced. I do. I really enjoy that.
What's your favorite food?
Ice cream.
What's your least favorite food?
Ooh, that's either going to be olives. I cannot stand olives. Or, I'm just going to go with olives. Yeah, just going to go. Don't put those in front of me. Can't stand them.
What's your favorite sound?
Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa music.
What sound do you hate?
The music my children listen to. Which is, sadly, I don't know. I failed as a parent. It's the pop music, the top 40. Oh, I feel like I need to run some kind of disk utility in my brain after I hear it. Oh, and just clean it up in there with some good Frank Zappa music.
That's right. What gets you excited?
Right now, it's my kids. I love my work. I love my job. I have a 9-year-old and I have a 3-year-old. And especially the 3-year-old, seeing everything through her eyes, the excitement, it really just gets me jazzed up for the day. And it always makes me remember that there is always something new to learn, that even what I see as being familiar can be new. I just need to look at it in a different way. And I just need to maybe change my mindset. And it's all about just remembering. Have that mindset of a 3-year-old. It gets me excited for my day when I remember that and when I think about them.
My 9-year-old turns 10 today.
So, oh, well, happy birthday.
And she's, I know what she's saying. She's, she has a way. She's a phenomenal human being. It's just amazes me. What turned you off?
What really drives me crazy and what will get me to disengage is when I see a few things, and it is really a lack of empathy for other people, right? Don't just assume you know what's going on. Don't just assume that you know better, right? Try to have some understanding. Try to meet people where they are. And in, hand in hand with that for me is a lack of problem-solving abilities. I always tell my team at work, there are no problems. There's only solutions we haven't found yet. So when somebody comes to me and says, well, here's the problem, and they don't look for the solution first, you've lost me. Mm-mm. Come back and try again, please.
I was listening to a podcast a couple of months ago, and the podcast was talking about an exchange he had with another person who basically said, if the situation you're in doesn't actually have a solution, then you don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Ooh, indulgence. So see, I eat too much ice cream, so I don't know if I can answer ice cream. That is a very tricky question. I think it might be really good pizza from a like the right kind of oven, brick, wood-fired oven. I don't eat it often, which is why it's an indulgence. You know, it's hard to get that just phenomenal, well-made Neapolitan-style pizza where everything is just perfect. And when you get it, oh, that's an indulgence. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. No, that part's right. Mm-hmm. Getting spectacular fill-in-the-blank is particularly difficult, but getting really superiorly well-made pizza and well-made pizza dough, that's a tough thing. So now I know that there's a whole library, but if for people who say, you know, I'm interested in learning some more about chocolate that I can do at home, do you have a book or two that people can read and that they can understand? It's written for people like me, who something that can help them on their way.
Yes. I cannot remember very openly. I cannot remember the name of the book, but Andrew Schatz wrote a book that is very good for the home chocolatier. And that is one I would just Google. He is a very well-known pastry chef and chocolatier. Andrew Garrison Schatz wrote a very good book, and it's all geared for the home chocolatier. Most of the books in my library are professional level books. Here's what I tell everybody. I tell people, don't shy away from those books, because most of them have been created to start a new professional at the beginning of their journey and then walk them through. There's one in particular. It's by Peter Grueling, Chocolate and Confections. The whole start of the book is all about
book.
It's all about the basics. And some of the stuff in there is a little more advanced. Some of the stuff in there, you might need some equipment you might not have at home. You can still, though, take the principles. Almost everything I've said he covers in that book, basic recipes and ratios for ganaches, basic troubleshooting. Having a book like that can really take what you're making to the next level, right? Now, there's also books like The Art of the Chocolatier by Ewald Nodder. The back of that book, though, is all showpieces. I'm not even making those at home. Still, a great book, maybe not the one you want unless you want some inspiration on your shelf. If anything, though, if you're looking for a good book that will challenge you a little, will still give you information that you can use and take actionable steps off of at home, the book by Peter Grueling. And he actually has two versions of it. One is meant for the home cook, and one is meant for professionals. And you can look those up. I do not remember. I only have I have like three copies of the professional version because I keep blowing through them and ruining them just from, you know, thumbing through them so much. you can look. It's pretty obvious, I know, when you go to all their major bookstores, you know, the difference between the two copies.
Right. One of the, it's out of my reach now, but I have one that I bought years ago. And so there's lots of ways to go in confections, but mostly, and this is, I'm inventing a distinction. There's chocolate and all other things possible. And boy, there's a lot of things possible. Then there's the not chocolate. And the main thing really there, and you can put chocolate in them, but you get into the marshmallows, which marshmallows are pretty easy. And there's lots of different variations on ingredients, but fundamentally it's the same thing. But the other thing that is really fun to do is fudge. And then we get into all of those things with lining up fat crystals and doing all kinds of stuff. And we may have to get you back on and talk about confections.
Oh, okay.
I did an episode a while back, just me puzzling through some of the stuff and my experience, but I think there's room for me to grow in confection, and particularly with the fudge world and getting into one of my favorite things to eat and make. I'm trying to cut out on sugar. Are the original version of Aunt Sally's pralines.
Okay.
Not the chewy kind. I like the kind where you put the baking soda into the caramel at the end and the, how it changes the structure and that and they snap.
Yes.
They're weird. Yeah, yeah. They're grainy, but they snap. Mm-hmm. They're cloudy, but it's like, man, this is a very bizarre thing, but they're addictive.
Yes.
And I put extra pecans in there because I like that toasted pecan flavor. Because, I mean, the syrup is fine, but man, the toasted pecan is only second best to a toasted walnut. I'm a walnut guy. Walnut and blue cheese.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's good. I've made pastries before with walnuts and blue cheese and pears, tarts.
Nice.
Yeah, I like to mix a little bit of savory a lot of times in with the sweet. And you just said it yourself. We can all always get better. We can all always work on what we do to make it the next level.
You know, it just occurred to me, we're talking kind of highbrow here, and I don't want to exclude the listener, but a really nice pear, blue cheese, and walnut pativier for dessert. I've had it. Fantastic.
Well, don't drop the mic. You might break it, but mic drop for you right there.
Very good. All right. Well, I'm going to stop there because we could go forever and we can't go forever. But thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate that. And I wasn't kidding about, if you're willing to do it, let's talk again about confections. And I will see if we can get into the weeds on that. Well, it won't be hard, actually, but we'll try to make the weeds at least navigable for most people.
Sounds good. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
You're welcome very much. This was a good talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. You too.
All right.
All right, folks. That's going to do it. I'll put links to the two books Braden mentioned on the show notes page for today, culinarylibertarian.com/186. I'll also add a link to the show with David Akimoto about baking the perfect chocolate chip cookie. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you listening. I also want to thank the Patreon subscribers for their support. I appreciate their contributions. You can become a patron or support the show in other ways with this link, culinarylibertarian.com/support. Please share this episode on your social media feeds and rate and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.